I still am a little surprised that I did it because I was not in a good place. I had deferred from that fall semester. I just was really struggling, really depressed and sick. And
we sometimes think about social media as a place where you mostly share the trivial stuff. But there are those times when it's the ideal space to express the difficult thing you haven't been able to say yet. In February, Whitney Griffith wrote out a Facebook post. And in it, she said, "It's time for me to share my story about one of the darkest chapters in my life." In the post, she said that she'd been trying to decide how to go about this thing, whether she would be able to even express this right. She wasn't even sure if she was completely ready to put herself out there. It was almost like she took this deep breath and wrote, "But the time is now." Griffith revealed that when she was a student in the music department at Utah State University in 2009, she had been raped by her piano instructor. She reported it to the school, but she said the university didn't take it seriously, that in the process, they even questioned whether the encounter had been consensual. Griffith had been inspired by another Facebook post of another woman who had a similar story, and these posts have triggered this wave, numerous stories like this about the music department at Utah State. This is More to Say. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, USU President Noelle Cockett held a press conference where she addressed these concerns.
Over the past year, we have witnessed a movement that is sweeping through our country.
The president admitted the university had fallen short and would be making some changes.
Step one in moving forward is standing up and admitting that we at Utah State made mistakes in the way we handled issues of abuse, of mistreatment of students, and even of instances of sexual assault.
Today, we're going to be talking about all of this with Jillian Friedman. She is with the Deseret News. She's been covering all of this. Also, KUER's Lee Hale, who's looking into the story as well. And welcome to you both.
Hey.
Thanks for having us, Doug.
Tell us a little bit about Whitney Griffith. Start at the music department.
Well, she was following her dream. This was what she wanted to do with her life. She was a transfer student to Utah State. She knew that they had a really good music program. She was passionate about the piano. It was her love. And she was going there. I mean, for the reason anyone goes to a piano department is that you want to do that professionally. You want that to be your life's career.
The thing that I loved so much that just made me so excited was just walking down the halls where there are practice rooms and you can just hear pianists just practicing, and it just fills the halls and everyone's working so hard, and it's something that I dreamed about.
It's different than being like in an engineering program or taking a history class. Like, this is your craft, you know? And it's a very vulnerable place to be. You have your professors scrutinizing you. You have a lot of one-on-one time with professors. They have a lot of power over you. It's important that they're on your side. It's important they like your performance. They like you as a person. All of this goes into, it's a really intense relationship, teacher to student. It's a really intense way to try to get validation and try to be understood and try to move ahead. You can't just be the kid in the back of the class taking notes. Like, you're on display. It's performance. This is you. And she was up for it. But it ended up being difficult in the way she hadn't anticipated.
What did she say happened to her?
She said that when she was a student at Utah State in the piano department in 2009, that her piano instructor had raped her. And she said that after it happened, she had conversations with her father and with a counselor and worked up the courage, even though she said it was one of the scariest moments of her life, to report this incident to the Title IX office. And she says that they didn't take her seriously.
It seems like part of the dispute, at least from the university's point at that time, was they perceived in these conversations that they were having with Whitney and with this instructor that this had been a consensual relationship.
They told me basically that what had happened sounded consensual, and nothing about it was consensual in the slightest. So
Whitney disputes all of that. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. That doesn't change the power dynamic in that relationship. either. So would you just say something about how she's reacting to the way the university talked about it? Because they said it was, I think the quote is, it seems like this is mostly consensual.
Right. You know, that's something Whitney and I talked about at length. And I think her primary issue with the way that she was treated was that she experienced what she felt was rape. In their conversation with Title IX officers, they essentially disputed her own characterization. They didn't give validity to the truth of her account. Now, we know in this whole Me Too movement that's come across, you know, that's affecting the nation, there's a lot of gray area in that. And I think that that's something that that is, you know, really something that is a point that is being discussed and addressed. But I think in this particular case, what was so troubling to Whitney was that she has maintained this entire time that this was a rape. And regardless of any other circumstances, it was a rape. Mm-hmm. And that they would not legitimate or validate that and take that seriously and investigate that.
Did she know at the time? Apparently not. Did she have any sense that this was happening to others? I mean, it seems like that there is this pattern here, but Whitney at the time had no idea about it.
At the time that she reported, she didn't.
Yeah.
But when I think what was so troubling for Whitney in the weeks after she did choose to report it was that she found out that other women were affected by the same person, this one individual. And it was so disturbing to her not only to have her own report not taken seriously, but then beyond that, to also have other women coming to her, or she was aware that other women were experiencing the same thing, and still nothing was done. And ultimately, I think for her, that was what made her. She says she had debilitating anxiety, and it was ultimately that debilitating anxiety that caused her to leave the program, leave this program that she loved. I mean, she said this was I was living my dream. I was doing what I had always wanted to do. My lifelong passion was playing music, and all I wanted to do was be a pianist. And it was ultimately the feeling that not only was her own report not taken seriously, but other people also affected by the same person, their reports weren't taken seriously, that made her feel like this isn't a place that I can continue to be a student.
So she, as you said, she leaves the department, she quits. She almost waits 10 years before saying something on Facebook. Why did she wait so long, did she say?
I don't think she ever directly told me, you know, why now, though she does say that in her post, this is the time. But I think for her, a year and a half ago, she noticed that a lot of women had been coming forward. And I looked back actually through Facebook posts and noticed that there was sort of a rumbling of this about a year and a half ago that someone posted and someone responded, and there was sort of a build there, and it never came out like this. I think maybe the Me Too movement really, you know, catalyzed this. But I think, you know, a year and a half ago, she started realizing, hey, this thing that I've sort of repressed, you know, in her post she addresses, I've moved on with my life. I've built a life outside of piano. I'm happy. And she moved on. But then she realized when all these other posts were coming out and all these other, she received, you know, word of all these other reports, that she felt that, that wow, this is something that I've repressed, but other people could still be vulnerable. And then when another woman came forward and actually put her post on, this was the very first post in February, she felt like, I can't stand by anymore. If it's not just me, if it's not even just this man, it's other instructors, it's other people, then I feel an obligation that I can't let this go anymore.
Lee, you talked with Whitney after the post went live. How did she describe the reaction she had gotten? We'll get to the way she was perceiving the department. What did she say the reaction was like?
She was amazed by the amount of people that were reaching out to her.
February 13th at 11:44. And I'll never forget that, because that's when my life changed, honestly.
People were reaching out to her directly, saying, this is my experience too. What should I do? And she said, I'm not in a position to counsel you about what you should do. I'm not a therapist. But she would share her experience and encourage and validate.
I never thought that I'd be able to help other people with this, and that has been so meaningful to me. I feel like being able to use my story to help other people, to help them find their voices and use their voices, has given me more meaning as a person that I thought I could ever have.
She said, with, you know, when she first came forward with her story, you know, after it happened, she had it was miserable for her. It was a terrible experience, and she thought, I'm never going to do that again.
Yeah.
So her coming out and sharing her story again, I don't think she ever expected to. And I mean, it was the opposite reaction. There was validation. There were people. There was outpouring of support, and there was this momentum too. Part of the, I mean, the Me Too moment is that things built.
Yeah.
And I think she felt it building. I think she felt the strength of other people coming forward. And also, she didn't. I think she stopped. She didn't feel crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it was no longer the story in her head or this voice that was, she felt like was, you know, solely her own. She was sharing that experience, which was really powerful for her.
We'll be right back.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
So what does she say the department was like? How does she describe the department? And we should probably point out, and we'll get to this a little bit later in the conversation, but there has been this independent report that's been released.
Yeah.
And what it seems to reveal is that they describe it this way, a hostile academic environment for women. Also talking about these people feeling frequently humiliated and psychologically abused by piano program faculty. So there's a pattern here. So how is she explaining it? How is she describing it?
Well, I think Jillian referenced that this is her dream. I mean, the thing that's unique about a piano department is this is your life's mission. But then you're put in this very vulnerable situation where people are critiquing this very personal art of yours, you know? And also, there's a lot of one-on-one time with instructors. There's class time. But there's also, you know, outside of class, it's you often take lessons. And she was taking lessons from this instructor. And
it's almost like there's this kind of level of intimacy that's
totally
quite particular to this, any kind of art form, I suppose, but something like this and that contributed to all of this, it seems.
And with the power dynamic, you know, I think about the arts. I didn't study the arts in college, so I'm just saying this from I heard from her, but people realize it's going to be hard to make it with this. And so whether what your professor thinks about your ability actually means really matters. Like their stamp of approval, what they say about you, how they treat you, how they interact with you. It's good. It's a good thing to be liked by them. It's a good thing when they show you attention, but the right kind of attention.
What did Whitney tell you about that part of the story?
I mean, I think what's important and what's maybe even tricky here is that it's inherent, I think, as Lee was saying too, it's sort of inherent to music and the arts. I studied classical ballet. I mean, these are art forms that require a huge amount of discipline, rigor. Often you're in an extremely intimate space with your instructor. They might be manipulating your body in some way. They might be touching you. They also might be yelling at you. They might be telling you that you're not good enough, that you need to work harder. And the question here, right, is where does that become not okay? Where is that motivational and inspirational and potentially, you know, the push that that kid needs or that student needs to become the great pianist or dancer that they have always meant to, you know, have always wanted to be and can be if they just can get there? Where does that transcend that and become humiliation, degradation, psychological abuse? And I think what we found from talking with Whitney, from talking with many of the other women and men that I spoke to in my reporting, was that it had crossed that line. And that's what the report found. I'll read one quote. Is it says, the training of elite piano performers undoubtedly must be rigorous and highly disciplined, but we do not believe there is any excuse for the humiliating treatment that some students experienced. So the report also acknowledged that this is a part of the deal, that a certain amount of pushing and rigor and discipline is part of it, but humiliating students, also overt sexism, you know, telling women that they're never going to amount to much because they're women and they're just going to have babies and that their potential is compromised because of their gender, that crosses that line.
Here's another thing that the report said. It said, we are unable to see how such treatment of students could advance any legitimate pedagogical objectives. Like, it was so bad, it didn't even make any sense, it seems.
Right. I think, you know, and the really, I think, poignant thing about Whitney's story and about the story of many of the people that I talked to was that it did have that impact on a lifelong relationship with music, with piano. I mean, for so many of these people, piano was the one thing in their lives that was sort of sacred. It was their outlet. And after these experiences, whether they were sexual harassment, whether they were humiliation, gender discrimination, it was so toxic. That word is used in the report. It's used in many of these women's accounts. That toxicity really permeated their relationship to the art so much so that afterwards they don't touch a piano for 5 years and maybe never touch one again, or they enter a completely different profession because they can't even stand to be around it. So it goes beyond just how did a professor treat a student. It goes to a sort of a toxification of an entire person's life that extends so far beyond that, that that the damage is almost lifelong. And I think that's what's so so devastating here.
How did President Noel Cockett explain the reaction of the university? Why did they wait until there had been a Facebook post, two Facebook posts, that made this public? How does she explain that?
I mean, first of all, I think President Noel Cockett's response, in my opinion, was, I mean, she just seemed very on it from the very beginning. When I first started reporting this, it was right as the Facebook posts were coming out.
Because she did respond right after the post,
oh,
right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. So I was seeing the Facebook posts, really, you know, nothing had come out yet. And I called the spokesman for the university and it was all developing. Like, they didn't even know what was going on. And the spokesman said she is with her child doing college visits and she's in California. But she's getting on a plane, and when she lands, we can give you a statement. And so she actually got on a plane, flew back to Utah to be able to address this immediately, regardless of, you know, whether or not it was true or what the extent was. So I think, first of all, you know, her response was very immediate.
How is it that there had been numerous reports about this department and nothing had happened until there were a couple of Facebook posts?
She's a new president. She sort of inherited a whole host of issues at Utah State. And so she was able to, I think, come at this with fresh eyes and evaluate what was going on in that moment and respond accordingly. But certainly, I think that is a big question, right? This had been going on since the 1990s, and there had been many Title IX reports filed. So how was it that those reports never made it up the chain? And the report does detail that, like the attempts to take this somewhere else in the university and how those really didn't see any follow through. One of the things in the report that is a recommendation is an overhaul of the Title IX office. And that's something that Noel Cockett said she's instigating immediately.
This reorganization includes leadership changes, the addition of more staff, increased compliance oversight, and a position to oversee prevention training. The authority and scope of Title IX must be undeniable here on the campus.
That seems like a systemic issue. If you have a woman who makes a report to the Title IX office and is told or dismissed with the idea that this seems to us like a consensual relationship, I mean, that's a problem.
Absolutely. And I think that's what we really saw throughout the report coming out and reading through what they found was essentially that was the focus really of the issue. It wasn't just that many people had come forward. It was the handling of those reports and the fact that even though there was multiple people talking about the same individual or the same individuals, that those never amounted to any sort of action either by the head of the department or by the Title IX office or by the university, that this was systemic and appeared systemic but was never handled as such.
Who's the head of the department when all of this was going on is the question.
Gary Amano, okay. Essentially, yes. So Gary Amano is the one that the report finds was responsible for this behavior, was responsible for the handling of it or the mishandling of it. Really, the report pretty scathingly places most of the blame on him because he was the one that when women did come forward, when they went to the Title IX office, when even the Title IX office contacted him, that he didn't handle that appropriately, brushed it off, or he had, you know, chit chats like Whitney describes, where he was sort of told that, knock it off, you know, don't be sleeping with students, but nothing more than that, nothing, you know, nothing further. So we really find that the report ultimately focuses blame on primarily on Gary Amano, and then recommends that the university dismiss him.
On Monday, April 2nd, Professor Amano submitted a letter announcing his retirement effective that day. Professor Amano is no longer working at Utah State University.
So basically, the president looked at the report, took the recommendations, and just wholeheartedly said, we're going to adopt all of the recommendations.
I think that was what was so stunning, really, for me, was that, I don't know, I think as a cynic, maybe, my feeling when they had this independent investigation was, wow, it's great that they're taking action, but what is this report really going to look like? What does this investigation really mean? And I didn't expect that it would be 18 pages of 60 interviews of people and an absolute basically blanket statement that things weren't going well and that really clear changes need to be made. And that on top of that, the president would then take each of those recommendations, say, you want Gary Amano out? Okay. You want Dennis Hurst out? Okay. And then beyond that, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a task force on gender discrimination, not just in the piano program, but throughout the entire university. That's going to totally reevaluate the process for grading, for scholarships, for hiring new faculty. We're going to have maybe a dedicated mental health counselor that's going to be there for students. We might put cameras in the one-on-one instruction rooms or make sure that there's observation windows. So I think not only did she address the recommendations of the report thoroughly, but then she also went beyond to say, what else can we do to make sure this doesn't happen again?
It's also extraordinary. I guess she's asked for more people to come forward.
That's right as well. And I think that's been consistent throughout all of my reporting was that, you know, this was an independent investigation. So when I was talking to many people who were saying, this happened to me and this happened to me, I would call the Utah State spokespeople and ask, you know, have you heard of this incident? Have you heard of this incident? And they would tell me, we can't comment on that because there's an independent investigation going on that we are not even allowed to contribute to. We're not allowed to say anything. We're not allowed to know anything. And the purpose of that is to make sure that we can't bias it. But what they always said to me at the end of the conversation was, if you're hearing from people who say they've been discriminated against or sexually assaulted or harassed, you should make sure they're submitting their reports to the investigators. And here's their number and here's their email and you should do that. And so they, throughout the process, were very encouraging of me as a reporter to make sure that the people I was talking to were getting their two cents in so that the investigators could handle that. And that's something that President Cockett reiterated in her press conference was that if you've also been affected and you haven't spoken up yet, speak up. And if as these changes are going in, you don't feel that your voice is being heard, let us know. And to me, that seems very genuine because of the way, even as a reporter, they were interacting with me.
Do you think the difference in the response here is the fact, the rather obvious fact, that this is a woman dealing with this situation?
I think so. I mean, does the fact that she's a woman account for all of it?
No.
Think not.
Yeah.
But I think certainly as a female president who is inheriting this problem, I think it was easy for her to sort of look at it with fresh eyes and say, all these women are coming forward. What's my responsibility as a university president? Well, it's to hear their voice. And I think being a woman and being able to identify in that way, I think certainly had an impact.
When somebody brought up the fact that she inherited the problem, she said, and I'm glad.
This is my call to action. This is exactly why I'm in this office. And I don't intend to fail.
Just an interesting moment where it seems sincere. Like she seemed, well, first of all, she seemed affected by it. It seemed like this was not something she was taking lightly. But also she said, we're going to fix this. And I think people have been watching similar cases like this all across the country. And there's probably a growing need for an example of somebody to really just handle it the right way or at least get their handle on it. And it seems like she is, she wants to be that person. She wants to do it right. She wants to fix it. And she wants to put an end to this kind of thing happening on campus.
You know what the saddest part of this story is, I have to say, is the thing that you said earlier, Jillian, that in your conversation with Whitney where she described her life now outside of piano, like that she gave that part up because of all of this. That seems like the worst part, I think, in some ways, that she gave up that really important part of herself.
Yeah, I think for me too, that's what's been most powerful and most poignant. I think there is this sense of you're also robbing someone not just of their college experience. It's not just this one moment, this one trauma, this one thing that you have to get over. It's that your whole relationship to something that is so fundamental to your identity is interrupted, is broken. And then what's left for you in terms of you have to completely rebuild that? You know, what's your outlet now? What's your solace now? What makes you you? What makes you feel safe? To rob someone of that, it's incredibly lasting and it's incredibly devastating.
Jillian Friedman is a reporter for the Deseret News. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lee Hale, thanks.
Thanks. More to Say comes from KUER in Salt Lake City. I'm Tim Slover. Lee Hale and I produce the podcast, and Doug Fabrizio is our host. Thanks for listening.